Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to The Waves for Thursday, January 3rd. I'm Christina Cotterucci, a staff writer at Slate and host of the Slate podcast, Outward. Joining me today is Verilyn Williams, who's a producer in WNYC's narrative unit. Welcome back, Verilyn.
Thank you, Christina. It's good to be back.
So good to have you home. And calling in all the way from Berkeley, California, is Slate staff writer Lily Loofborough. Welcome back to the show, Lily.
Thanks for having me.
So this show is our first one of 2019. Happy New Year.
Woo, woo, woo.
Yes.
We're
in the New Year of Fright.
Yeah, we're recording it in 2018, so I really feel like a time traveler here. It's pretty special. So we have a very special episode to kick off the New Year of the Waves. We are spending the whole podcast today answering your Is It Sexist questions. We have a whole slew of good, juicy questions on our docket. They're all from listeners, and we've been preparing so hard for this and ready to give you our extremely scientific and unavoidable answers. And for our Slate Plus segment today, we're answering another listener question. This one is not quite straightforwardly, is it sexist, but it's really interesting. We're going to talk about how a truly innocent person should respond if falsely accused of sexual harassment or assault. So if you're not a Slate Plus member yet, you can and should start your free 2-week trial by visiting slate.com/thewavesplus. All right. First question. This one comes from Fiona. Let's listen.
Hi, The Waves. My name is Fiona. I'm calling with an Is It Sexist question. Can you tell me if it's sexist that I prefer a female-led work environment? I'm a degreed engineer who worked in oil and gas before switching tacks and have since worked in academia and healthcare. I dealt with a lot of toxic masculinity and mansplaining. When I took my current role, my boss and three of the execs at the company were women. It was a fabulous, supportive work environment. Well, it's been a few years, and the boys are back in charge, and frankly, I miss my matriarchy. Every mention of dirt biking and the cowboys makes me cringe. Is it sexist that I want to work in a woman-led workplace again? Please help. Thanks.
All right. What do you guys think? Is Fiona being sexist for wanting a woman-led work environment?
This is like I kind of equate this to like, can non-white people be racist? Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where it's like, I just feel like I just think that if you are constantly having to, balance, you know, broness, or having to balance mansplaining, or having to like have to think about that and think about strategies to kind of work around that or be productive in the midst of that. Not having that around is like a release, and this allows one to, as I'm speaking from personal experience, allows one to get that much further in your work.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, I guess technically, she's assuming that all men will come with that type of baggage to the workplace, which is sexist. But if it's based on her experience, then I would say that maybe it's sexist, but I give her a pass for once.
Interesting. Yeah, I kind of agree that I think what you were saying at the beginning is like, it's hard or possibly impossible to be sexist against men because men don't suffer from sexism, you know, systemically. So, yeah, my first instinct was like, no, this is not sexist at all, because what she's chafing against and what she doesn't want is sexism. So toxic masculinity, you know, in the many forms that that can take. Mansplaining, which is a real thing in a work environment. And I imagine as a degreed engineer who probably works with, you know, male engineers, she might experience some of that. So I don't think that it's sexist to point out that it's more pleasant for her to work with people who don't engage in mansplaining, you know, if that's true. And I think there are real differences in how women conduct themselves. I don't even think that. I mean, it's been proven that, you know, women conduct themselves differently on a team and in positions of authority. So I think it actually makes a lot of sense to want a woman-led work environment, especially, you know, considering the experiences Fiona's had in the past.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, workplace culture has been male by default for decades in ways that we don't even really think about or see, like, you know, conventions ranging from like the famous like office temperature debate, you know, because men are wearing heavy suits, right, to making deals on the golf course, like, you know, all of these things that are conventions developed by men and for men. And I think it is really amazing when you walk into an environment that doesn't force you to conform to, you know, hobbies and pastimes and even metabolisms that aren't yours. And it's not sexist to want that ease because, as Verilyn was saying, like, I think it actually lets you do your work better. But I think it might be sexist if you structured the hierarchy at your office such that everyone around you had to do it your way or else they'd be seen as less than.
What do you mean?
I mean that because the default has been, I think, a certain form of male sociality that is perceived as the way that you move forward and are advanced and make professional contacts and progress, I think that is sexist. And I think doing the opposite thing would be sexist, too. In other words, if, you know, all deals were struck, oh, God, I don't know how to
in the
do this without
room.
Stereotyping over manicures or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like if you made female pastimes inescapable and conditional for professional advancement, then yes, I think that would be sexist.
Yeah, I think the part that I'm just like, to this point, that we're assuming that all women won't, you know, like, because I've been around women that steal my ideas, or, you know, the same things that we kind of like, I feel like I'm hyper aware when it's a male, when I'm like the only woman in a male room, like, are you repeating something that I just said and pretending that it's your, there's something that you came up with, or, you know, are you expecting me to remember your golf trip and spend all day helping you with a meet, like something that's not my job, like the things that I'm always like, because we assume that women are supposed to do in the workplace. I feel like sometimes women can be guilty of that too. So I think maybe the sexist part is assuming that the things that she wants to escape from a male dominated office, that she won't get it in a female dominated office.
See, like, maybe, but also there's a reason why those things are associated with men, and why she in particular is associating those things with men, because they are, you know, I don't think she's making a comment like no woman would ever, you know, act like I'm dumber than her. But in general, you know, she has that experience more with men. I do think, though, if that turns into I'm not going to hire men and I'm only going to hire women,
right,
that becomes unethical and possibly illegal, probably illegal.
Most definitely illegal. We get the, you know, hate men. What's the right wing group for men? I don't even know.
National Coalition for Men. Yeah, totally.
They'll be on it.
And I don't know. Like, the one thing that does give me pause is her mention of dirt biking and the cowboys. Like, it sounds like some of what she's objecting to are these you know, structural and also socialized behaviors that men engage in far more than women that are exclusionary mm-hmm. to women. But also just like not sharing interests with your coworkers is something that I definitely feel among women I work with, too. You know, I've definitely mm-hmm. worked with women who would talk to each other a lot about like weight loss, which is really uncomfortable for me to be around and like makes me feel bad about myself. And, you know, right. it's not yeah. an interest mm-hmm. I share with them. And that's something that I don't think men talk about a lot, at least not in my experience and certainly not in the workplace. So, you know, I think that's something that you might find no matter what gender your workplace is dominated by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right.
But I think the fact that she's not saying like, oh, I want to work with women because, you know, women are pushovers. I can boss them around and like they're so dumb. Like that would be sexist. You know, I don't think that anything what she's saying is sexist against women. Definitely. So let me get my calculator out. All right. I will give this, I almost want to give it a zero, but I'll give it a one just because of the, you know, we are kind of engaging in gendered stereotypes here.
I mean, I'm going back and forth because I feel, so, I mean, I don't think it'll be a problem for me to share this, that I went back to a company that I worked with before, and it was, I mean, public radio is very, very, very white. But going back, I felt like there were like so many more people of color around, and I just felt like, oh man, like coming from Slate, which is like predominantly white, I was like, oh man, like it's so interesting to just see this many more, I mean, not even people of color, black people. Like we have an ERG, which is an employee resource group, which is just for black people. And at Slate, we had one, but it was for all the PLCs in the company. And it's one of those things that you didn't know that you needed it until you have it, right? And by no means is public radio like the home of diversity, right? Public radio is still very, very white. But I, you know, I don't know whether I would have, so in thinking about that and thinking about the difference that I feel being in a company that is a little bit more diverse, I am going to also maybe, yeah, I guess I'll give it a one because I understand what it, I don't think the desire to have it. Now, if you're discriminating or making choices or, you know, making a work environment that is like not, like men would not be able to survive in, then that would be the sexist part. So one.
Lily, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think missing a different workplace culture than the one that you have is human and personal, and also you're kind of the subordinate party wishing that you had different leadership.
Yeah, true.
So I think that is not sexist to me, so I would maybe give that a zero. But if, again, you know, if you wanted to produce a workplace culture that required stereotypically female behaviors and hobbies in order for professional advancement that is unrelated to be granted, I'm going to say that would be an 80. mm-hmm. You know, like, but that's, I don't think that's what this question is. Yeah.
So zero then?
Yeah.
We might have our first... wow. Decimal place answer. So 0.6 repetend sexist. Fiona, wow. You are in the clear.
Yes, you're good.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
All right, question two. This one's from Lauren.
Hi, my name is Lauren Bissell. I was just going to ask about age. tweet that went viral recently. It's by Amber Roberts, and her handle is Astronomer Amber. I mean, you probably saw this tweet. It says, I take out both of my laptops for airport security. Random guy scoffs and says, what do you need two laptops for? Me, well, one is for my astrophysics work and one is for my artificial intelligence work. And the hashtags are girlboss, AI, women in tech, priceless women and stuff. And I'm wondering if this is an action of sexist. I feel like if I saw someone with two laptops, I might ask them why they have two laptops. I don't know, but I also feel like sometimes men will have these dumb little conversations with me, the kind of conversation they would not have with another man. So I'm wondering if it is sexist that this probably bored security guard who's just trying to make his day better, her day better, be a little nicer, asks, why do you have two laptops? Is that sexist?
Can I take this one first?
Please. Yes. Go for it.
No. No, your competence isn't being questioned. It's not like people think that a person with two laptops is like better or smarter or more powerful than people with one and is like casting aspersions on your gender or sensing some like incommensurability between her and her laptop possession that's gender based. No, there's no assumption in the background here that makes this sexist. No.
Wow. Yeah, my first instinct on this was kind of to roll my eyes. Like, I don't love tweets like this. It really annoys me. And I think it gives a bad name to, you know, hashtag women in STEM, hashtag women in tech who are actually facing discrimination in their workplaces. I definitely don't think that this man was assuming she wasn't smart or, you know, didn't have an important job. And honestly, I do wonder why you need a separate laptop for your astrophysics work and your artificial intelligence work. Like, is there some like really intense software program that takes up all the memory on one of them? However, I think even if the question itself and the, you know, assumptions that may or may not be underlying this question isn't sexist, the question of why do you have two laptops, I don't think that this man or any man would ever make such a dumb small talk comment to a guy in line for security in the airport. I never see men making stupid small talk with each other in the same way that they make small talk with me or with other women. So, like, this has kind of become a pet peeve of mine, like when men say hi to me on the street, even if it's not a catcall or leering or anything, I just always think, you know, you wouldn't have said hi to a random guy walking by you on the street, even just to say like, hey, how's your day going? Like, I'd never see men just like engaging in that sort of, oh, I wasn't paying attention to you. I was looking straight ahead, possibly lost in a stream train of thought. And now you're going to force me to sort of look at you and smile and perhaps like giggle self-deprecatingly, which is what I would have done if somebody said, why do you have two laptops? Like, oh, well, my astrophysics and then my artificial intelligence. Blah. Like, that's just my instinct. Due to sexist socialization, and I get pissed when somebody interrupts me during my everyday life to, you know, ask me something dumb when we didn't need to have a conversation to begin with. Verilyn, what do you think?
Oh, you both have. So my initial when I read this, when I listened to this question, I'm such an airport snob. I'll just go ahead and say it.
What does that even mean?
Because I just, you know, the people that travel in the holidays because they never travel any other time. And now we have to deal with you not knowing you have to take off your shoes and your belt. I probably would have just like, if I would have seen her with the two laptops, my thought probably would have been, because you know, you're supposed to put your laptop in a container all by itself. Mm-hmm. And so I would have probably, I probably would have rolled my eyes like, oh, newbie, like, why is she traveling with two laptops?
You know, that's like, oh, sexist. Why, like, why did you not assume she's an astrophysicist?
I would, if it was, but I think I would have had that thought whether it was any gender, any combination of identities. I would have just been like, why are you traveling with two laps? But I think I also would have assumed that if the TSA person was talking to her, it was because she didn't follow the directions or she didn't put it in two different bins. And I would assume, because usually if you do all the things, like, they often don't even know whose stuff is who, right? So, like, if you are just, like, rolling with the punches, so she probably put two laptops in one bin.
In the tweet, and now it says it was a random guy,
yeah,
not the TSA.
I hadn't noticed that either. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a random guy.
That does change it a little bit, in my opinion.
Yeah, because also I do, you know, I buy that TSA. I've seen, you know, TSA workers in the airport line make all kinds of dumb small talk with everybody. And I just figured, you know, their jobs must be pretty boring sometimes unless they find something fun to confiscate. So I would put them a
maybe
little
he was
slack.
Missing his flight. I don't know. My original thought was a little bit along the lines of what Lily said, but what you just said as far as the ways in which our days get interrupted in ways that, like, even there might have been other reasons why he, even if he thought it, he wouldn't have said it out loud to a man. So yeah, that does increase it on the sexist scale for me. But I just wanted to be honest about what my initial thought was, which is just like, I mean, maybe he just said something because you were doing the most at the airport line.
So it was more judgy.
I'm gonna like out myself here as a 2-laptop owner who travels with them.
What kind of impressive STEM work do you do, Lily?
It's classified. Yeah, I mean, I was just noticing that it is a random guy and not the TSA guy, which I think our caller might have misinterpreted, and that I do see your point, Christina. Like, I think that is annoying. But I actually have seen guys ask each other that kind of thing too. Like, that particular kind of especially when it comes to like tech stuff. I feel like there's a version of kind of bro-y aggro competition that can rear its head. So I totally agree with your like general principle that being stopped on the street and told to smile or whatever is intolerable and 100% sexist. The fact that this random guy is scoffing at a fellow passenger and questioning her needlessly makes him a total jackass. I'm still not sure it's sexist.
The other thing that stood out to me in this tweet was the use of the hashtag girl boss, which I know I think on Hannah and June and Noreen's week, they talked about. I mean, you know, if you really want to be taken seriously and are getting mad that people don't take you seriously as an astrophysicist and an AI programmer or whatever, like perhaps don't qualify the word boss with the marker of your gender, and especially maybe don't call yourself a girl.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I also, you know, I think the excuse that our caller Lauren gave, like, oh, you know, maybe this person was just trying to make her day better. I don't believe that anyone thinks anyone's day is going to be better by, you know, you interrupting their train of thought to say, like, hey, you know, why the 2 laptops? Like, eyes in your own bin. Although, you know, perhaps it like, really was like an annoyed, I'm running late and, you know, I'm mad that you have so many electronics that you need to put in a bin.
Well, she does say that he scoffs, so it's clear that he was like what, you know, like, why do you have 2 laptops? Like, why are you, like, taking up more time in the line? I don't know. I think that's the way that I read it, but I think she does go on to say, you know, men will have these dumb little conversations with me, the kind they would not have with another man. So, and like, taking out the tweet, I think she used the tweet to kind of talk about what you were talking about, Christina. So thinking about that, I'm ready to rate this.
Ooh, okay. Well, yeah. What would you rate?
I definitely, because I also have an inability not to smile when someone tells me to smile. It's the bane of my existence. So I'm going to go ahead and give it a 6.5.
Okay. Lily, what do you think?
No, I'm just going to give it a 0. I don't think it is.
Wow. You are a hard ass, Lily.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it's a 3. Not sexist. I don't think he was assuming she didn't have an important job or wasn't a scientist, but it is sexist. I think there is about a 3 level sexism to just randomly interrupting a woman's life to ask a meaningless question. So we're pretty well split on this. And because Lily ran it a 0, I win. Our average is 3.16 repetend. Thank you for the good question, Lauren.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Our next question comes from a listener named Sarah.
Hi, The Waves. My name is Sarah. I am calling from Austin, Texas. And I was calling because I recently went to a concert. It was general admission. It was outside, all a single level floor, which everybody was standing around watching a central stage. And as usual, I was having a hard time seeing the front stage. Not to my surprise, but all of the guys standing, or all the people in front of me who were blocking my view were guys. And guys of all different heights. I'm 5'6", so not particularly short, but many guys were in front of me blocking my view. And I spent most of the concert hoping that they would leave their spot or tilt their heads another way or something. And then I looked around and I saw so many other women having the same issues, many women that were much shorter than myself, just staring at the ground, not able to see the front stage at all, which is one of the main things you want to do when you come to a live concert. So my question is, are general admission concerts sexist? Thanks. Bye.
I love this question so much. And I should
say,
I'm 5'2". I think we should all disclose how tall we are before we answer this
question.
5'1". 5'3".
All right, so we're all shorties. Our producer, Danielle, who is nice and tall and comes from a family of basketball players, is shaking her head right now. Maybe we'll have to get her input on this, too. But I love this question because it's something I think about a lot as someone who loves music and is short and always has been short. And one moment of like extreme vindication that I felt in my life as a concert going short person was when I worked at the Washington City paper and we had an etiquette issue. And I interviewed Bob Boylan from NPR, NPR Music, you know, All Songs Considered. He goes to, you know, hundreds of concerts a year. If you go to concerts in DC, you see him at everything. I asked him what good concert etiquette was. And one of the first things he said was, if you're tall, you've got to move to the back or the sides. Mm. In fact, at the Tiny Desk concerts at NPR, which, you know, all folks at NPR can go and see these musicians play live, he'll say when he's introducing the band, like, hey, short people, come up front. If you're up front and you're not short, like, make some room. And I thought that was he didn't gender it or anything. But, you know, as we all know, on average, you know, women are shorter than men. I felt like that was some good allyship on his part. And he isn't short. So, you know, he wasn't necessarily benefiting from that. But it also made me think of the Riot Girl movement. And, you know, it's accepted practice at punk shows and other concerts featuring feminist acts to say girls to the front or femmes to the front. And Bikini Kill and other Riot Girl bands sort of pioneered this practice. It was seen as kind of revolutionary at the time because men would be in the front, women couldn't see. Also, men would be moshing in the front. And if you're short and you're in the mosh pit, you're going to get an elbow to the eye instead of like the torso or some other body part that can better tolerate moshing. And also in part because when the women were on stage and a lot of times they're singing about sexual violence and whatever, they wanted to see women in the front and not men. And I think that general concert etiquette in the crowd or disregard for what I think should be concert etiquette is sexist.
That's totally fascinating. I am so glad to know that. Like, I don't go to concerts for this reason. Like, it just it's boring to me because, the line about just staring at the ground, not being able to see the front stage and all these women doing that is so sad. But it's so true. Like, it's just what I end up doing. And I think it's one of those problems that is invisible to taller people because they don't understand how maddening it is to be somewhere and end up like enclosed staring at a bunch of backs, you know, but it just like I didn't understand that people reclining their seats on airplanes causes tall people physical pain, like, you know, that the constraints that different people have to deal with are really not visible to those who aren't similarly troubled. But I do feel like this is less sexist than heightist. I mean, that's not a thing, but it is a thing, right? I mean, tall people to the back and the sides makes so much sense as a solution to this. But I'm not sure that, I mean, should tall women be in the front?
Well, so here's why I think it's sexist. Because I think most of the time I've seen, and even as a short person, I'm aware, I'm looking around, I'm like, can everyone see? Like, sometimes I don't even sit because I usually have a big afro hair, right? And so, like, if I'm in a place where it's a seated event, I'm aware of, like, who's around me. Can the person behind me see, you know, the stage? So my, just by experience of going to general admission places, I think men are just less self-aware. Like, they're just less able to, like, just check, you know, make sure your community around you is, like, okay. So that's the part. Like, I just think on average, just based on, you know, being at places where people, you know, first come, first serve, that I tend to see women looking around and, like, checking in and just being like, hey girl, are you okay? And, like, even, like, allowing me to go in front of them. Whereas with men, but I'm also able to ask. Like, I ask, and I, but that also sometimes it's like you have to smile and you have to do the whole, like, can you, like, you know, like, do me a favor. Like, I'm really good at that. And so I just use that to get to the front and to be able to see. But I noticed that I have to do that a lot more when there are men in front of me.
Yeah. To your point, Lily, I think you make a good point, but also I think we should recognize that height intersects with other systems of oppression, and, you know,
true.
You can't totally separate height from sex and gender. Danielle's shaking her head again, but I'm not sure if it's just that something she's thinking of unrelated. I really want to get her on the mic here, if you wouldn't mind, Danielle.
Danielle,
as a tall
woman,
I think we need your perspective.
Okay, so I'm 5'8".
Oh. That's, like, not even, like, that tall, but I guess because I'm so short, you seem extremely tall to me. And
it's,
you have,
like,
a presence.
Tall enough. Like, my sister's almost 6 feet. Like, I come from a tall family. I think, for me, like, there are times that, like, there are men, when men are, like, over 6 feet, it's, like, hard for me to see at concerts, but I feel like, generally, when I'm at concerts, I let shorter people in front of me, because I'm like, yeah, I can see over you, and I don't generally see men doing that.
So it's not a problem for you because you can see over them. So why not move to the side or the back or whatever?
Yes. Yeah. Like, I'm happy to oblige. Like, I know that I'm on the taller side. So
thank you for recognizing your privilege.
Just try to be a good ally to the short people out there.
The other thing that I do want to recognize, though, is that people aren't always in, you know, relationships or friend groups where everyone is the same height. So it's, you know, there is the possibility that you'd be, like, breaking, you would be forced to stand in a different place than your friend. Or, you know, if you want to stand, if you're, like, a tall woman with a shorter partner, you're, like, one of you is going to be either not able to see or blocking someone else's view unless you find a good spot over by the side where everyone can be happy. So I don't think there's a simple answer to this. But another thing I want to mention is that this especially bothers me at concerts or shows or whatever that are explicitly feminist or you know, involve a band that is very outspoken politically on social justice and equity and, like, radical redistributions of power. Like, I went to a Pussy Riot show, for instance, at the Black Cat, a really great general admission concert venue in D.C., Pussy Riot, like, a feminist, like, pretty socialist, I would say, band or performance art group from Russia. And all their songs are political. And, like, there's just dudes up at the front, like, pushing through, blocking women's view. And I'm like, it seems like you don't really deserve to be there, or you're kind of not listening to the message if you're a dude trying to get to the front of this feminist punk show. And, you know, not to call out anyone in particular, but I've noticed also at the shows that we do, the live shows for The Waves, this very feminist podcast, a lot of times men are the first ones to come to the mic to ask a question. And I try to make a point to say, you know, not that there's anything wrong with men asking questions at the show, but I do think that if you are a man in a space that is feminist and trying to envision a society that is more feminist, you should possibly think harder about making space for other people, women in particular.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think everyone knows where I stand on this. I think that maybe not general admission shows in general, because I can't really think of a good alternative to general admission standing room only shows. But I do think that the fact that, like, men will refuse to or you know, insist on just standing in the front because they can and maybe they got there first is sexist. I'm going to give that an 8.
Yeah. I guess I feel like I've gone back and forth in my head. I guess I'm going to be very egotistic, like self-centered, and just talk about my own experience. And when this has happened to me, I felt that it was a man not like being self-aware. So I'm going to give it an 8.5.
Okay. Lily?
I totally agree that you're right that height intersects with gender and other parameters, and that's correct. And this really has actually stopped me from going to things. So I resent it deeply. And I think part of the problem is I end up so furious about it that I really can't even enjoy the thing. Because anyway. But anyway, so I do think it's a radical failure of empathy whenever anybody does this, because you're just destroying the experience for the person behind you.
Radical failure of empathy, I like that.
But I don't know. I guess sexist is just sort of a complicated category. So I'm gonna say 5 because I think it's height. I mean, I agree that it's an intersection, but I think the height is the really key term, and that really the directions that we're giving are also largely just to tall people. I don't know. So I'm gonna say 5.
All right. Our sexist rating is 7.16 repetend. Pretty sexist. Everyone, please take our advice into account the next time you go to a concert. All right. We've got an unidentified caller next.
Hi, The Waves. Is it sexist of me to dismiss Elizabeth Warren as a potential 2020 candidate based on her decision to take a test about her genetic markers and to make a speech on foreign policy that doesn't ring true?
This is a really interesting one. Who wants to go first?
I mean, I can start. I think there's going to be a lot to say about this one, but like, I would say, I mean, strictly answering the question, no, those are not sexist reasons, but, I think it's also worth noting that we're actually very good at rationalizing our decisions after the fact. Like, humans are not rational actors. We decide things on impulse and for reasons that are often very opaque to us. Mm. And, you know, one of my favorite experiments, like, gives people, like, these two images to choose from. And they pick one, but then they're shown the image they didn't choose and asked why they chose that one over the other. And they always come up with a reason.
Mm.
So I think that there is real opacity to the way that we decide things, and that we, it is wise to keep in mind that we don't understand our own internal processes very well, and that internalized biases and sexism and racism and all kinds of things are managing us in ways we don't quite understand. Dismiss is the kind of word that makes me worry. He said, you know, is it sexist of me to dismiss Elizabeth Warren as a potential candidate? Look, I see male candidates survive bad decision after bad decision and loss after loss without people writing them off the same way they seem ready to whenever a female candidate does one thing they dislike. And I do think that is worth thinking about.
I co-sign 100% because I was just thinking, like, the reasons that he gave, I was just like, our current president said that he wanted to grab women by the pussy and people still voted for him. And so, yeah, I totally think that this is like 100% sexist, because the idea of dismissing her as a candidate, despite her political record, but there's so many reasons to like choose not to. But when something about the word dismiss makes me feel like you just like wrote her off, like, and I think that there is a way in which female candidates can be wrote off as opposed to campaigned against, or, you know, like taken seriously as someone that could win, even if you don't agree with, you know, her political leanings or the fact that she decided to take a genetic test, which I guess I don't even understand that as a reason to dismiss someone. Maybe I don't understand the issue.
Well, so the very valid arguments against Elizabeth Warren for taking this test, she was trying to prove that she had Native American ancestry. And, you know,
Can I just interrupt to say Trump kept attacking her as like Pocahontas?
Yes, exactly.
So in response to that and to shut down that line of argument, this was a very bad attempt. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, yeah, you're totally right, Lily. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of indigenous activist groups and, you know, plenty of Native American tribes have come out and said, like, this is exactly the kind of thing that undermines tribal sovereignty because we don't decide tribal membership based on genetic tests. And in fact, genetic tests cannot accurately determine ancestry, and it advances a lot of really harmful ideas about the biological basis of race and tribal identification. So, you know, I too, especially after reading a lot of pieces that, you know, folks with Native ancestry wrote about it, I too really am kind of upset that she did that. However, I think it's important to note, as you said, Lily, that she did that in response to a sexist attack from Donald Trump. Rebecca Onion wrote a really good piece in Slate, I thought, about why the Trump's Pocahontas insult was not just racist, but sexist. And it was about the idea that authenticity is something that we don't take seriously. We think anytime a woman is trying to, you know, make authentic statements about herself in public, that she's doing so to be manipulative and that she's lying in some way. So I think that if you are responding to her response to a sexist attack by dismissing her, I completely agree with you guys. The word dismiss stood out a lot to me, too. Then, you know, you might want to consider whether you also dismiss out of hand every other candidate who has done a regrettable thing. So, like, if you think that her taking that genetic test was racist, like, think about, like, do you also dismiss Bernie Sanders when he said that, you know, oh, a lot of these white folks who didn't feel comfortable voting for a black person aren't necessarily racist? You know, do you dismiss him for that? Do you dismiss Kamala Harris's do you dismiss Kamala Harris as a possible candidate because she was a prosecutor and she defended the death penalty and, you know, three strikes rule in California? And, you know, I think that there's the way you put it, Lily, was like more eloquent than I ever could, that like there you can possibly make decisions that are backed up by logical reasoning, but that aren't those logical reasons aren't necessarily the whole story of why you make that decision. And I think there's a difference between deciding you don't want to vote for someone and dismissing them as a viable candidate, because women have had to exceed, you know, much higher standards to be seen even as electable, because you have to be seen as able to overcome sexism from voters. So I think people's perceptions of sexism of voters can also make them make sexist decisions. I also was curious about what her speech on foreign policy, what didn't ring true about it, particularly because, you know, women have to work a lot harder to be seen as tough in the foreign policy sphere. And I'm not sure if that's what this caller had an issue with, but
this is slightly random and tangential, but I found it really interesting to think about. So I don't know if you guys saw, there was a recent interview with Melissa McCarthy about her time doing stand-up. And one of the things that she said kind of blew my mind, just because I hadn't thought about the dynamics of, you know, doing a type five or whatever when heckling is a concern. And so she said that, you know, when she was doing stand-up in the early days, she would get heckled, which, of course, every comic has to figure out how to deal with. But in her case, it tended to be things like take your top off or whatever.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And obviously, that's not a form of heckling that male comics have to deal with as they're coming up and refining their material. And B, she said that the thing that really bothered her about it was that they wouldn't stop, that the heckler won't stop until you totally annihilate them. So what she developed a way to do was to just attack the person until they 100% shut down with shame, like insulting them in every possible way. And she's saying, you know, and they finally do, but you feel horrible about it because you've just done this to a random person you don't know. The room feels bad about it because it's not actually fun to watch somebody get destroyed verbally like that. And then you've used up 3 minutes of your five doing that, and now you have to transition back to your actual material.
Oh, God.
And she was like, I just couldn't, I was exhausted from doing that. She was like, I just, and it was so revealing to me, right, to think about the amount of work that I think a lot of women have to expend on countering the attacks before they can even get to the thing they are doing. And that's why, as much as I object to what Warren did with that genetic test, like the impossible position that she was put in, because if you look at the articles preceding that, they were all like, well, she's going to have to address this, you know, this question of her lineage, because Trump had made it central to her candidacy. And so she did. But it really, it was a no-win situation, except perhaps for actually including Native communities in her discussion, which she didn't do and should have.
Yeah.
So, again, I think that the criticism of her is totally fair and valid. But that McCarthy thing just stuck with me as, like, the energy suck that goes into trying to neutralize those attacks before you can even begin to refine your work.
Yeah. All right, let's rate this one. Is this listener, which thank them for listening, and a great question, are they sexist? I'm going to say 7.5.
I mean, I feel like the challenge of this question is that it's aggressively framed to make us respond to the reasons mm-hmm. that are given. And no, I don't think those reasons are sexist. So answering the question straightforwardly, those are not sexist reasons. I do think dismissing a candidate for those two reasons might be. So I'm going to say 4.
Okay. Verilyn?
I think dismissing her as a candidate, even if you don't agree with her, how she's, you know, her political choices and her policies, like just the act of dismissing her as a viable candidate is extremely sexist. I also think that we don't have enough information, so I'm going to give it a 7.
All right, 6.16 repetend. That the listener is a little bit more than halfway sexist. All right, our next question comes from a listener named Tanya.
Hi, my name is Tanya Neely. So I have a question about saying please in workplace emails. Early in my career, when I was a design assistant, I sent an email to our client requesting CAD files that we needed to do our job. It meant something like, hello, can you send me these files when you get a chance? Thank you. My supervisor was CC'd on the email and told me that I should say please. That was at the time that lean in was a big deal, and as a woman in the workplace, saying please just felt like it was putting me in a lesser power position, and the comment from a male superior felt condescending. I think my email was perfectly polite and not demanding, although tone can be hard to translate in emails. I also fear that by adding please, the tone could be read as, can you please send these drawings? Anyway, that comment still bugs me years later as I have to send emails requesting information daily and I always end up with an internal debate about whether I should say please. I'd love to hear what the panel thinks. Can you please answer my question on the call-in show? Thank you.
I love that Tanya asked us to answer her question.
I know.
I will jump in and just say that I obsess about things like this all the time. I'm the kind of person that will write the email, then go back and take out all the like I thinks and the please and the unnecessary things that we're socialized a lot of times as women to do. So I absolutely resonate with this, and I absolutely think that the fact that, I mean, it might also be like a age thing, but then I don't know whether he would have said that to a new young male employee to say please. It's just like, I think that the idea that when a woman asks for something in a very direct and assertive way, it's always like a, oh, like, because we're so used to women apologizing for doing their jobs or apologizing for, you know, the amount of times I say sorry when I'm just trying to, like, someone is literally in the doorway on the train and I'm trying to get in the train and I'm like, oh, sorry. And it's like, wait, damn it. Why did I say sorry? I just need you to move. It's your fault, you know? So we don't know, but I do still think that it's often an expectation and all, maybe it's a subconscious, this internalized sexism that we always have to, like, please people or, like, go out of our way to kind of, I don't know, like, it's like if you ask, yeah, like if you're asking someone to do a job, that's their job. Saying please is like, why do I have to say please for you to do something that's not, like, it's naturally part of my job to ask you for this and it's your job to do this. So isn't it your responsibility?
This is one of those things that I think maybe, you know, instead of telling.
Don't say I think. You should just say what
right,
you think.
Marilyn. I'm sorry. Sorry, please can I continue speaking? This is one of those yes. things that definitively we should change the workplace standards to
make them more like what we only ask women to do. So I know women are often told, you know, stop putting exclamation points in your emails, stop doing please, thank you, like start demanding things instead of asking for them. Don't raise your voice at the end of a sentence. I think actually a lot of these Oh my God, now I'm in my head about this. A lot of these things actually just make workplace interactions more pleasant. And I think instead of telling women they need to be more like men, we should ask that men be more like women. I have had I have seen a marked difference when I've had a male boss versus a female boss in my comfort asking for things I need. And taking criticism, because, you know, when women will put exclamation points on things or say please and thank you, or, you know, sandwich a criticism between two compliments, and a lot of the male bosses I've had haven't done that. And, you know, that could be coincidental, but I don't think it is, just based on every other account of workplace behavior I've heard from women. And I just enjoy, I think it's a lot easier and more fun and more comfortable to interact in an environment where people aren't just being aggressive and not engaging in these niceties.
That's a fascinating point, and you might have changed my mind about this. Wow. Yeah. I mean, one of the more life-changing documents for me, I feel like, when I was sort of getting started trying to write on the internet was Corey at the All published this thing about how men and women pitch stories. And he was really just saying, like, look, I just think it's worth printing a couple of examples so people see. And, like, you know, so, like, the inquiry letter from a man that he published was, like, do you take pitches? Should I just write something and send it? Do I have to tickle the balls? Oh, I want to write for the All, damn it. And then inquiry letter from a woman, as a longtime admirer of your site and non too frequent registered commenter, I've been too shy to pitch as I've never felt like my work measured up to your fine standards. Ugh. Right. And I was definitely number two. And I started to be a lot blunter, and actually doing things that to me felt kind of rude, to be honest, in my emails. And it worked. Wow. And it was horrifying to me.
It's so funny because I often, and this is how much I think about this, because as a producer, I send a lot of emails and I'm always asking people for things. And I think that when it's something when I'm reaching out to someone first, I I put a lot more niceties, and I do the whole, like, you know, I love you, like the sandwich stuff, like, you know, like context, question, context, ask, like all those things. But I now tell myself that it's better to just respond right away via my phone, because if I do that, I can be a lot more blunt and direct. Because honestly, all that consideration takes up time that I don't often have. So I often feel like it's so much more work to do the kind of niceties that we have been socialized to do. And I'm envious of, like, not being able to just say the thing, because often that's my instinct to say the thing. But then I go back and kind of being like, oh, like, I'm just like, how can this be heard? Like, who am I emailing, and how can I write this in a way that they would actually hear me? And I often feel like I'm actually able to be heard if people see the, like, please excuse, this is sent from my iPhone. Like, I think that people are often more able to hear a direct response from me when it has that on the bottom. Like, it's almost like the longer I take to respond, the, like, less they're like, wait, what? You know, and I've been accused of being too blunt sometimes, or too, like, why did you ask me in that way? Or, like, you know, did I do something to you? And I'm like, wait, what are you talking about? You mean when I asked you for this thing that you told me you were going to get to me, like, last week? So, yeah, I've been on the other side of the, like, trying to just be blunt and having to reconsider.
That's super interesting. I mean, Christina, the reason that you're convincing me is because, I mean, I did that. I think I have enough residual training and, like, you know, language of supplication that there's probably a balance I'm unintentionally striking. But I will say that, like, I agree with you that the bosses that I have had who have done compliment sandwiches constantly, it has been such a pleasure to work for them. And when I don't get that, I feel super insecure and scared.
Why? I'm always just like, is this so much? I mean, I'm not saying why, like, you have to answer why, but I think, like, that's the thing that I have in my head, because I'm a people pleaser, and also ultimately I think any good manager, any good boss, or, you know, when you want something for someone, is you have to let the person, you have to be heard, right? And so, like, regardless of what your intention is, if you say something in a way that the person can no longer hear you because they're caught up in, like, oh, did I do something wrong? You know, then that's less efficient for me. And so taking the time to think about and consider it is worth my time. But I just wish that I didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
Because I would just be so much more efficient.
It does make me really sad to listen to Tanya's question and hear her say that she always has this internal debate about whether she should say please. I mean, it seems like such an insignificant, small word that doesn't take long either to type or to not type, but it does carry a lot of weight when you're thinking about how are people going to judge me if I don't write please versus my male counterpart who doesn't write please. Okay, so what's the is it sexist question here? Is it sexist to demand that someone write please in their emails? Or is it sexist that women are expected to write please?
It sounds like it's that, yeah. I mean, so Christina, how would you feel about this as like a proposed guideline that like, I do think that adding please feels like conceding power a little bit for some reason. Like, and it's stupid that graciousness should like have come to mean that, but that's what happens to things that are feminized. And it's horrifying. But like, what if it's a thing where like the bosses and those in power always include the pleases and the grace and those on the other end don't have to as much and can be blunter.
I like that a lot, because if it's coming from a person in power, you already know that, you know, it's mandatory that you do that, and it's not making a request. It's basically an assignment.
Right.
Also, the fact that she phrases this as a question, can you send me these files when you get a chance, instead of please send me these files when you get a chance, or just please send me these files. You know, I think there are a lot of, it's not all hinging on the word please. There are a lot of ways that this is sort of,
exactly. It's conforming to like the basic like supplicant format anyway.
Yeah. I think the idea of like her boss saying, say please, is that that it's going to be taken as like a demand. But the idea that the fact that she already said when you get a chance already implies that you don't have to do it immediately. But when you get a chance,
it's at your convenience.
Yeah. So saying okay, please so is kind of redundant.
Let's say, is it sexist to expect or to ask someone who works for you to write please in all their emails?
I am going to assume that this boss would not have done it if it was. I guess we don't know, but my assumption is that if this was a male employee, he wouldn't have registered that she didn't say please. So I'm going to go ahead and give this. And also just because of how much time it takes up in my life and how many emails I send, I'm going to go ahead and give this a very, very high score of 9.
I'm going to say, I agree with you, Verilyn. I can't see somebody asking a man to, you know, write please, in addition to phrasing it as a question and saying when you get a chance. I'm going to give it another 8.5.
Yeah, I think I'm at 8.5 too.
We've brought you over, Lily. We've brought you over to the dark side.
You guys convinced me.
All right, 8.6 Rapiten. That's your answer, Tanya. And please don't feel obligated to use the word please in your emails going forward, unless you have to for your job. All right, recommendations. Who wants to go first?
I can go first.
Go first.
I want to recommend an interview by the one and only Oprah Winfrey. She just recently interviewed Gabrielle Union and Dwayne Wade. They just welcomed their first daughter into the world. And Gabby, because we're on a first name basis nickname, Gabby talks about her journey to motherhood through surrogacy. And it's like she says things that I hadn't really even considered in this, the different ways that surrogacy can come about. She also did IVF, in vitro fertilization. She's tried to give birth in her body 9 different times through in vitro and failed, and had like 9 different miscarriages. And then realized that it was because of an undiagnosed, I'm forgetting the thing that she was diagnosed with. And the thing that she was diagnosed with was something that showed up for her in her early, I think like in her early 20s, and she was put on birth control. And so it was just interesting to kind of think about the ways in which, like, a lot of times when women, older women, are trying to have babies, she talks about like age is a thing that like always comes up. Like everyone says, like, because of your age. But actually what it was something that just went undiagnosed from her 20s because she was put on birth control to take care of the symptoms from this diagnosis. And I thought that was just like just something that I'm just so glad we're at a stage now where everyone, like women, are just more able to just speak openly about these things. Cause like, you know, if I do decide, you know, wake up one day in my late 30s and decide like, oh, actually I do want to have a baby after all. I don't have to just trust that what my doctor is telling me. I can, you know, I don't have to go through it myself. And it was just so great hearing Gabby talk about this. And then the interview talk about intersectionality. Like it also went into raising Black boys because they, Dwayne has, sons that she's been a stepmother to. And then they even go into like, you know, what does it mean to raise a Black woman or a Black girl? And I was just so, appreciative of hearing like these two superstars talk about their experiences so openly in a way that like not only it was telling me something I didn't know, and it's like I may one day have to go through this. And it was just great to hear something new, because I think as media makers and people that consume so much, there's so much information back and forth, and I was just like, wow, this is actually something I've never heard before. And I'm just glad we're at a time where women can be open about their journey to motherhood and have it be like different every time. Even Michelle Obama, which I don't know if you guys have read her book, she talks about her journey to with Malia and Sasha through in vitro. So I'm like, wow, like, is this common? And like, why does it feel like we're just at a point now where women are talking about this?
Sounds like a really fantastic interview. Good recommendation. I am recommending two things. The first is the act of buying yourself stuff from holiday gift guides. This is a tradition that I celebrate with myself mm-hmm. every year as I'm looking at gift guides, thinking about what to get my family and friends. I buy things for myself. So normally I don't recommend things that Slate published in this section because I think it's a little egotistical, but we did publish a very good gift guide. You can find it if you just Google like Slate 2018 holiday gift guide or something.
Googling as we speak.
I bought something on it that I need to recommend. It's a hot sauce. But the word hot sauce is really an understatement for what this is. It's recommended by Slate editor Laura Bennett. It's called the Lao Ganma Chili Crisp Sauce. It comes from China. You can order it on Amazon. This thing has changed my life, I swear. I've had it on grilled cheese. I've had it on roasted cauliflower. I've had it on eggs. Laura Bennett recommends it on pizza. You kind of spoon it onto things. It's textured and crispy. There's chili peppers and peppercorns in it, entire soybeans, like little edamames. It's garlicky. It's not incredibly spicy, but does have a nice zing to it. There's MSG in it, which, like, I'm a huge MSG head. I just can't get enough of it. You'll want to eat it on everything. I think this is the first time I've even recommended a food on this show, but I couldn't rest until I recommended it publicly somewhere. So buy yourself things on Holly Gift Guides, especially the Lao Ganma crispy chili hot sauce.
Yes.
Lily, what do you have?
So what I want to recommend is actually an old movie. It's from 2012, and it's called No. And it was directed by Paulo Larraín, who's a Chilean director. And the reason I'm recommending it is because it has given me a lot to think about. I'm going to just tell you briefly what it's about. So in 1988, when Chile was still under the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet, there was, under international pressure, he agreed to have a plebiscite where people could vote to either keep him, that's the yes vote, sí, or to get rid of him, and that's the no vote, no. So people could vote sí or no. And it had been long enough since elections had happened that they actually had to kind of teach people what a ballot was and how to, like, write onto your ballot correctly. But the really interesting problem that they had was that People were so apathetic at that point because when you've been under dictatorship for 16 or 17 years, you don't really believe that's going to matter. An election seems like it's probably going to be rigged. So anyway, the story of Noah is about Gael Garcia Bernal stars as this guy who was hired to spearhead the campaign for the no side, which had the weird challenge of trying to both like highlight all the atrocities of the dictatorship and also get people really excited about voting.
Wow.
And so he was so Chile, I don't know if you guys know this, but it was like a great neoliberal experiment. Like Pinochet brought in the Chicago Boys and it became like a free market, like petri dish, where free market principles were allegedly given, you know, a license to run. That's actually not totally true, but that was the line. So it has since become a very commercial minded country. So what this guy did was actually decide that, no, you actually couldn't put all the sad footage of the disappeared people and their families because it was too lame. And you had to instead, he commissioned a commercial jingle.
Oh, my God.
For the campaign and put together these 15-minute, for a couple of weeks, he was allowed 15 minutes on TV every day to, like, put something out for the campaign. And so they would put out these almost psychotic, like, melanges of, like, you know, people happily riding on horseback carrying the Chilean flag, and then they're partying, and then they're having a picnic with baguettes, and then they're dancing down the streets of Chile singing the jingle song, and the symbol was a rainbow, and the campaign was no. It is one of the most truly schizoid campaigns that has ever been conducted, but it actually speaks so, and it worked. The no won. It got people out of their apathy. I mean, it's a more complicated story, but it's such an interesting movie because it explores how how political despair is paralyzing and how a really disappointingly banal like commercial campaign might have helped to save a country by getting people happy and singing jingles. Anyway, it blows my mind every time I watch it. And I watched it recently and I've been thinking a lot about like what positivity is even possible in this political moment. And I feel like it has a lot of bizarre sideways lessons to that about that.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of something that Al Gore has talked about in regard to climate change, which is that like, you need to give people something to hope for and to live for. Otherwise, it's, you know, what will motivate you to do anything if you think nothing will change and, you know, there's no hope for you. That sounds really, really good, Lily. All right. That's our show for today. Thank you to our production assistant, Alex Barish, our producer, Danielle Hewitt. And happy 2019. For Verilyn Williams and Lily Lou Furrow, I'm Christina Cotterucci. Thanks for listening.